Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. This is part two of our conversation with Gil Hance. If you missed part one, be sure to check it out in iTunes, Stitcher, or on the website. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a review in the iTunes Podcast Center. This really helps us out, and we really appreciate it. Without further ado, here's part two of the Gil Hance Podcast.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
What's something that you wish the regular golfer understood more about your job?
I think that there's a lot of nuance and subtlety and thought that goes into, there's not many things that happen by accident. Although sometimes good stuff happens by accident, but you keep it for a reason. So I think that there's a lot of thought that goes into every little bump and bounce on a golf course, most every contour that goes into it. And, you know, myself included, most average golfers are just trying to get the ball airborne and just, you know, not thinking about strategy or the different, the way things are impacting the game in sort of very quiet ways. And so I think that that's something that people look at our golf courses and think that sometimes there's just comes about by happenstance, but for the most part, everything is really well thought out and well planned, and is hopefully having an impact on the way the game is played, or at least an impact on the thought process of how people approach it.
Is there like a particular green or hole at one of your courses where you just worked on it for seemingly days that you just couldn't get right for a long time, and then you finally got it?
I think what tends to happen is we sometimes you get fooled. you at the end of the day, you're shaping something, and then you go and you survey it and you check out the grades and make sure everything works and make sure everything's going where you expect it to go. And so I think more often than sort of working to get something, sometimes you're working on it and then you survey it and you shoot it and you're like, oh my God, that's doing exactly the opposite of what I thought. And that can be an influence from surrounding slopes, or you just don't judge the grade. You're trying to build a green that's going back towards the player, and the ground is all falling away and your eye is just deceived by the way the ground sits. So I think that there's more redoing or struggling or sort of more frequent edits based on the fact that I'm not seeing what I think is actually happening. And when that happens, it's kind of funny. Actually, we get a good chuckle out of that. So it's that's more frequently the way it works. And because a lot of, we've been very fortunate recently to work on a lot of sandy sites. And so we can refine the contours and greens all the way down until the very last second. Like if you're building a USGA green, once you build the cavity, you're pretty well stuck. I mean, you can play around with an inch or two here or there, but you can't just make 6-inch cuts or make a lot of big edits to the, because then you're screwing up the profile of the green with the gravel blanket and the whole thing. So on sandy sites, we can shape something in with a dozer or an excavator and then put the sand in place. But then we've got a lot more fine edits that can be made with the Sand Pro, or that can be made with rakes and shovels. So I think that allows us to continually refined, hopefully improve, and sometimes that process goes in different directions than you ever thought it might go. And again, that's hopefully the results that come from that are better than what you intended when you started out building it.
So we're at Pinehurst, and you just finished up the third course at Stream Song. How's building a course at an already established property different than building one at a new property?
Well, you have um, you have other courses that you're responding to, whether you're doing it purposely or not. It's just, you can't help but understand that there are other properties here that you're trying to make a golf course that is compatible with, but you're also trying to make a golf course that hopefully quality wise is at least equal to what already exists there. So as it relates to Stream Song, it was interesting because both golf courses are by, you know, the modern guys that we respect the most. So you got Bill and Ben doing the red course and Tom Doak doing the blue course. So we were putting our work alongside, you know, the modern architects who we think do the best work. So there was a standard that was held up at that point in time that we wanted to respond to. There was a style that, you know, we all sort of generally live in that rugged, rough, rustic style. So we knew that was going to be compatible. And then we looked at, all right, how do we differentiate it? And it was at Stream Song, it was all about the site. You know, our site was bigger, broader, not nearly as dramatic as far as the landforms are concerned. And red and blue were purposely commingled and co-designed to flow together. So they're a little bit more compact. So the reaction there was, okay, let's look at it from a scale perspective. Let's try and do something bigger and maybe a little bit bolder than those two golf courses. Here at Pinehurst, the reaction is to a completely different, I mean, it's a historic golf course. It has been a standard for greatness in this country for decades, designed by one of the greatest architects of all time, and then restored by, you know, the greatest architects of the modern era, Bill and Ben. So we're looking next door and we're literally abut course number two, and you know, a lot of people said, well, you're going to build greens like course number two. And I thought, no, that'd be the stupidest thing we could ever do, because the finest example of those greens already exists right next door. So what are we trying to do, outdo course number two? So no, we, you know, there are some elements of the greens on course number two that might find their way into to our greens, but for the most part we're trying to build a golf course that's compatible. And you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say that there's sort of competition. I mean, we all try to do our best work, and so we don't want to build the golf course that's considered to be the worst at any of the places we work. And you know, I had a great fortune of being at a dinner last night where Bill Coor was speaking, and he said, you know, these resorts and these destination places, they really succeed only when the quality of golf is spread across the entire spectrum. You know, if Bandon had five golf courses and there were two of them that nobody wanted to play and three that everyone wanted to play, well, then that doesn't work. You want to have the five golf courses spread equally. And same thing in Stream Song. If, you know, it's easy, and I think it's great that, you know, there are people who love each, every, you know, there's people who are big advocates for blue. There are people who are big advocates for red and similarly for black. And to be able to have those conversations, and you know as well as I do, when you have conversations about golf architecture, there's no rights or wrongs. There's no black and whites, but there's just all these shades of gray. And so people like them for all those different reasons. And so, you know, I don't think it's ever our expectation that, of course, we're going to build something that's going to outshine course number two. But we wanted to build a golf course that would make people who come to Pinehurst Resort say, hey, you got to play number two, obviously. But now you really have to play number four also. And it's been an interesting project. Bill and I joke an awful lot about how we just follow in their footsteps, and he's the trailblazer and pioneer, and he gets to live in the rough and rugged, you know, establishments. And by the time we show up, the hotels are done and everything's perfect, and we get to live in Donald Ross's house, and we have a little bit of back and forth banter on that. But anytime you get to work alongside those guys, and anytime you get to work at a place as historic as Pinehurst, I mean, how lucky are we?
What are some of the biggest challenges that you faced with number four? It's a course that was originally designed by Ross, for people that don't know, and then it's been worked on by Robert Trent Jones, Reese Jones, and Tom Fazio.
I think the biggest challenge we had, and what's been the most interesting thing from our perspective, is that through all of those various iterations, the golf course became detached from the landscape. I mean, there was a lot of different shaping. There was a lot of different earth moving on the site. And, you know, Ross considered it and wrote about it, that it was probably the most dramatic of all the sites he had to work with here at the core of the resort. And it's got great topography and great interest. So our goal was to try to reconnect that landscape. was to start, put the ridges back where the ridges were, put the valleys back where they were, not, you know, just looking at tree line to tree line and reconnecting the landscape. So it was an interesting exercise. Normally when you're building a new golf course, you're trying to find the golf holes and you're trying to find the places in the landscape where they exist. With course number four, with just a few exceptions, we were working in the same corridors of the golf course, so the routing didn't change dramatically. But within those corridors, our goal was to reconnect the landscape almost as if we just found it in its natural state. And then once we put the landscape back, then we all started talking about, okay, where do the bunkers go? What's the strategy? Where are you supposed to hit it? How does this whole thing fall into place? So it was kind of a backwards exercise of restoring the landscape before you even then start designing the golf holes. And it's been fun and challenging. And I think that, a lot of credit to Brent Vest and Brett Brennan and the guys that are sort of doing a lot of the heavy lifting on our projects and doing a lot of the shoving and pushing around. And I think they've really nailed it. They've done a great job with restoring that landscape. And now we're all sort of, the rest of the team is following behind. And I think we're making some very interesting design decisions, some of them based on what Ross had done. We have the old aerial photographs from course number four. So we've taken some of the bunker patterns and some of the sort of grassing lines from that golf course. But at the end of the day, it'll be one of our original designs. And we're really excited about how we think it's going to fit into the overall landscape here in Pinehurst.
It's a cool sight, having walked around it the last couple of days. It's got some movement, some dramatic, holes. It's a cool piece of topography. It's a lot different than number two,
but thanks.
You fly over it. You go from two and then the landscape stays consistent across, which is neat.
Thank you.
Another new design you have is a Hoopy Match Club, and it's a course that's built for match play. And it's pretty neat that keeping score and talking about your score is frowned upon there. How is building a course for match play versus traditional stroke play?
I think that Jim and I really enjoyed that opportunity. Working with Mike Walrath, the owner, he's just one of the greatest guys, and he loves golf. He's passionate about it. He's a good player. And so when he came to us and we talked about this piece of ground, which oddly enough, he was looking for a piece of ground in Georgia, and Jim and I had worked on this particular property back in 2007. We had looked at it with Davis Love and looking about building a golf course there. So we knew of the character and the quality of it. And now this is a completely different approach to how we tackled that landscape. But we introduced Michael to the land and he fell in love with it immediately. And so one of those projects that's kind of come back to us, which we're delighted about. But when we were approached also about doing the match play component, Jim and I were excited about the thought of, hey, we can build holes, we can take a few more chances, we can build more heroic type setups where there's a lot of risk reward, that if you take on the big challenge, you're going to get the big reward. And if you play away from that, you're going to have to work to score. But the thought was, nobody's writing a 9 or a 10 on their scorecard. It's just, you've lost the hole. So why not, gamble with some pretty big stuff? Because, all right, you just won down. And I think that mentality was refreshing. It was liberating for us. Because so often you're focused on, all right, what's the playability and what's ultimately the score that somebody's going to put, or how do you design based on the notion of par? And I know we all sort of in this circle of golf architecture aficionados, par is irrelevant to us, but it's not to 99% of the golfers out there. That's really what they measure themselves up against. And the card and pencil mentality is unfortunately the reality. And so to be asked to design a golf course where the card and pencil mentality is thrown out the window, and as you said, frowned upon, liberating is really the only word I can use, because I think it just allowed us a fresh perspective on that landscape. Now, that landscape allowed us to build some dramatic golf holes and to have some really dramatic sandy features, utilizing some of the beautiful live oaks on the property, and then the variety of golf holes from along the lake at the start, which one of the nice things about working with Michael was, you know, the quintessential sort of American golf course and Southeastern American golf course would finish on the lake. You know, you'd have your par threes or in your par fours and the heroic, you know, all that stuff. And with the beauty of that landscape, we really felt like that was the worst part of it. Now, it was a place we decided that would be the best place for the clubhouse because the beauty of it is fantastic. But we wanted to finish on the really cool, choppy rolling ground in the sand as opposed to finishing on the water. So we went to Michael with the routing, the final decision. We said, hey, we understand it's a really nice visual resource, but we don't really value it that highly from a golf standpoint. So can we have hole number one where you're overlooking the water and then hole number two where you're actually playing it and then see you later? And he was like, yeah, that's a cool idea. I'm fine with that. So it was good looking at from a routing standpoint. We had all these diverse landscapes. We had the along the lake to start, and then we had kind of rolling down into the woods, lower ground where we had to, you know, actually is hole number four, as Jim refers to, as sort of an architect's hole. We had to make that hole to connect the dots. And then you emerge out of there on five and six. And then by the time you hit seven, you start to get into this great rolling ground and the live oaks. And then, you know, by the time you get out on 10, you're out in the meadow. Then you're back into the live oaks and rolling around and finishing in that regard. So it was a wonderful landscape to be able to try to execute that thought process of building a match play course. And then because it's remote and because, you know, people are going to be staying on property, we thought, all right, well, if you're, you know, maybe somewhere down the road, Michael might build another golf course. But for right now, you know, there's this 18-hole golf course. What can we do within the property that might allow you to have a different option to play? You know, I'm 54 years old. I love to walk and carry or have a caddy, but 36 full holes by the end of the day, I'm done. And I'd like to, you know, be able to enjoy having a libation and having, you know, some sitting around with the guys and having a good time without just feeling like I'm about to fall over asleep in my soup. So we thought, well, what if we create another loop of golf holes that would be, we started referring to it as the afternoon round, and thought, well, the afternoon round could be a much shorter golf course, much, you know, really a little bit more compact as far as walking is concerned. And so the concept became, well, what if we tack four holes on, short holes, into the routing, and then do this combination of where you play the first hole, then you skip over to six. And then you knock out so a couple of big long par fives and some of the longer walks between holes. And then you play 7, 8, 9, 10, and then you jump into A, B, C, D. And then that loops you back in across. And then you jump into hole 11, but not playing it as a par five, playing it as a short four. Anyway, the creativity involved in that, the final routing of the afternoon holes was Jim Wagner. I mean, he came up with even the idea of crossing over one of the other holes that you've already played. And so now you've got a around 6,000-yard golf course that plays under par 70, and you're just, it's a fun alternative to get another 18 holes in but not feel like you're getting beat up. And then the four afternoon holes, there's a really short par 5, a really short par 4, and then two par 3s. So again, it's a much smaller, tighter loop. And within all of that context, this Mike Walrath is just, you know, gave us the freedom and the ability to think outside the box. And he encouraged and welcomed that thinking, which matched his thinking about, I'm going to build a club where we're going to embrace the spirit of match play. And we're going to just enjoy that component of the game. So it's one of the most special and interesting projects that we've ever been involved with. And I am excited for people to get a look at it.
Something I noticed with Stream Song Black, a Hoopy, even yesterday I walked around Pinehurst Forest. Seems like, is walkability something that you think about? Because those were some of the most walkable courses, like even compared to the other courses at Stream Song Black. I feel like you're fresher after a round at Black than you are at, you know, one of the other courses. Do you think about that?
We do, because I mean, we're big believers that walking is the way the game is supposed to be played. And we would never begrudge somebody who physically needs a cart and that's the only way they can play golf. You know, that's great. Go ahead and take a cart. I mean, we're big proponents of push carts. I think that, you know, pull carts, whatever you want to call them, I think that unfortunately, there's a stigma around that here in the United States, which, you know, you go to the best clubs in Britain or in Australia and everybody's pulling their clubs around. I think anything you can do to get people to walk is the essence of the game. And, you know, golf courses have always been meant to be enjoyed at a walking pace. You know, Jim and I refer to it as golf at 55 miles an hour. When you're in a cart, you're just blowing through the landscape. You're not in touch with it. You're not in contact with the ground. You're not feeling the undulations. You're not visiting with everybody in your group. You know, if you and I are playing in a cart, we're basically spending 4 hours. Well, hopefully it's only 4 hours, you know, together, you know, whereas the other two guys, we're just going to see them up on the green and then that's it. And that's the only time we're going to get to be with them. Whereas when you're walking, you're constantly changing, depending on which direction your ball went, you're walking with a different person and you're getting sort of to enjoy that experience much more. So it's, in our minds, walking is gets you the feeling of being in nature, being on the ground, sets the right pace for the game of golf. So anything we can do within our designs to help keep that in the forefront. So we put tees and greens in close proximity. We look at the opportunities that exist where not a lot of people are going to be playing the back tees. So maybe we'll sneak the back tees a little bit closer. And then, so you're just kind of, that then makes the forward tees, you know, sort of walking in progression. You know, you're just sort of moving in those direction, in that direction. So I think it's one of those things where we're cognizant of it. We're big believers that we want to push the envelope as much as we can to enable walking to be comfortable. And, you know, I think one of the things we love so much about these great old classic golf courses, we love the features, we love the variety, we love the way that they sit in the landscape, but we also love that compact nature of just sort of green next tee. And there's just something that's right about that. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of what went wrong with golf architecture in the 90s and 2000s is just, you know, the golf courses weren't being built where golf was the primary focus. A lot of them were real estate driven, and that just lent to the cart mentality and not, you just couldn't physically walk the golf course. There was so much separation between holes. And so I think what we're focused on, what Bill and Ben do, what Tom Doak does, I mean, we really are trying, we've been really fortunate to have these types of landscapes where we can build walking golf courses and owners that embrace that feel. But within that, we feel very strongly that we want to push the envelope as close as we can to make the golf courses as compact as possible.
We talked about par with regards to a hoopie. If you could remove par from one of your other courses, which one would it be?
Probably the Olympic course. I think the Olympic course in Rio, you know, we purposely designed it as a par 71. Because we thought that in a developing country or with a golf course that's going to be on the world stage and a lot of sort of developing countries watching golf in the Olympics, that there was the opportunity to show that golf doesn't have to be 7,500 yards par 72, that there can be a differentiation in par, and par 71 is fine. So we built that golf course with a ton of half par holes, really just thinking that the flexibility that's afforded in that would be fun to watch and fun to play. So I think if that golf course really just par was irrelevant and it was just go out there and play golf. And I really, really wish that golf in the Olympics would have had a match play component to it. Would have been so much, I think from our standpoint, it would have been much more compelling and interesting, and there could have been a team competition. And you know, it was great. We were fortunate that we got to see Justin Rose and Henrik Stenson battle down the final golf hole and make decisions on how they played that golf hole to win a gold medal. And so I think from that standpoint, it was exciting and thrilling, but it would have been so cool to see them play match play on that golf course.
Yeah, I think if they did the way the NCAAs have it, with like they do the stroke play and then they got 8 teams that advance and they do match play in, it would be really cool. But I think that people always say, well, like fielding a team of 4 is a lot harder for a lot of countries, or 5, fielding a team of 5. But I think that would lend itself to upsets too. So it would be kind of neat to see if somebody could take down America.
I agree. And then the other thing is that you know, all you need are two. I mean, you just need two to make a team. And you know, you look at all the other sports, and if a country, you know, there are a lot more American swimmers than other countries because they qualify. And if more Americans qualify or more Brits qualify, well, then that's because they've earned it. It's not because it was given to them. So if the Americans can field two teams of two, and you know, Sweden can only field one team of two, well, that's just because the way the ranking system set up. So there were a lot of reasons for why they did what they did. And at the end of the day, it was very successful. So there's, you know, you really, it's hard to complain, but it, you know, I think us purists would have liked to have seen things a little bit more creative.
Building the cradle here at Pinehurst, short course, 9-hole, par 3, I guess. What kind of different liberties and different things can you do when you're doing a short course versus a regulation course?
Well, the thing about the cradle was that everything about it was predicated on fun. I mean, we like to try and build golf courses that are fun to play. And, you know, some people say we do a good job of that. Some people say we don't. There's some too difficult occasionally. But, you know, we think, and we've read a lot about it. You know, I think it was Simpson and Weatherid's book about a sense of humor and golf architecture. And I think that, you know, a lot of the earlier architects felt like that was an important part of the personality of a golf course, was that you wanted to have some humor in there. And so when we were tasked to try and figure out how to lay out a short course on the ground that they gave us, Jim and I looked at it and just thought about fun. Let's just build fun holes. Let's try and build, you know, a variety of ways to play these golf holes, a variety of ways to approach them and attack them. Let's try and make them feel like they sit in the landscape quite nicely. There was no edict to build 9 holes. It was just whatever fit. Jim and I both thought that if we could retain the two greens that were there. So the originally where the cradle sits was originally holes 1 on courses 3 and 5. And so we kept the two greens just as sort of an homage to the work, to the holes that were there. So that was always going to be part of the routing. So then it was just, how do we tackle this side hill site and try and get a variety of lengths and angles, et cetera, and uphill, downhill. And so once that all fell into place, it became a focus on just fun, you know, and we looked at how do you play the, you know, punch ball green. We purposely put a flat spot above that green so people could sit in, you know, Adirondack chairs and watch shots come into it and cheer and yell or whatever. So it was one of these things where, again, a little bit like a hoopie, where you weren't worried about the quote unquote shot values. You know, oh, is this green going to be receptive to a 4 hybrid, or what's the potential range of shots people are going to hit into this green and what angle? It was just like, okay, people are going to drop a ball on this tee and they're going to figure out the best way to get onto the green. And for the most part, the shots are under 100 yards. So everybody should be able to tackle that. And I think one of the nicest compliments we got was from Rand Morissette, who, you know, Golf Club Atlas, he played out there and he just loved it. He said, you know, you can see that every class of player can find, you know, a challenge level that's acceptable to their game. There's a lot, you know, you can literally putt on every single hole if you wanted to. Or there are hole locations there where a guy like yourself, who's an accomplished player, you got to hit some shots. I mean, you can't just fake it. But if you're not worried about posting a score and you're just out there, I mean, Tracy and I have played it a number of times. We play in 45 minutes. We have a ball. I mean, it's just, it's all about fun. And that's I think something that's been missing from the game a little bit. And I think if we can inject that into the game and get people attracted to the game, or, you know, just sort of say, hey, there's a much more relaxed vibe that goes with this setting here, as opposed to a lot of the sort of high stress levels that people associate with golf, especially when they're first coming to the game, then I think the cradle will be successful in that regard. And I mean, and they gave us the front yard of the resort. I mean, you walk right out of the clubhouse and it's just there, right there in your face. And for Pinehurst to recognize that, you know, this prime real estate should be dedicated to fun and just people out there having a good time, I think really sends a great message to the rest of the golf industry of where some of our priorities should be.
It's funny. I I went around it a couple times, and I played with this older gentleman one time, and I just was using a 7-iron and a putter, and I could see him like looking into his bag, and he's like, oh, dang, I forgot my, because like he had a, like a 9-iron through wedge, and he didn't hit it very far, but you could tell like he saw me like running it off different stuff, and like he wanted to do it. And it's so interesting, because it brings, I think it, that these types of courses have the, you know, ability to get people to use their imagination more on the golf course, as opposed to the traditional aerial American golf.
I agree. I mean, I think it's one of the things that we love to put into our designs, and we love watching, you know, Augusta seems to be the one time a year where you actually get to see it on TV, or the Open Championship, is that, you know, when guys look in a different direction to get from A to B, as opposed to the direct line. And I think that that adds so much to the fun quotient and the fun factor, as we say. So I think that's great that he was able to see that. I mean, that's one of the nice things about the cradle, is when you walk past it or when you drive past it and you just see the smiles on people's faces and you see grandparents out there with their grandkids. It, in a way, it's almost the most successful thing we've ever done, because it has captured the imagination, and it's really done. It's everything we had hoped it would do. It seems to be doing, and that's really gratifying and rewarding in itself.
Say you were tasked with building a municipal course. What would be the core principles?
Yeah, I don't think the core principles would change from what we believe in. I think we try not to dumb down golf courses, just because of, you know, we maybe put, like we did at the Olympic course, maybe more short grass, quote unquote, hazards, you know, humps and bumps and hollows that you play through instead of bunkers. But we like to build wide golf courses, so I think it would stay wide. I think that the recovery options would still be there. I think angles would still be relevant. You know, it's not something that we go into each project and we say, hey, this is X. I mean, we obviously the client is going to dictate some of that. I mean, they're going to say, this is, you know, we've hired you. And we have the conversation. This is what we need to accomplish. This is what we want to do. So a municipality would have its requirements, and we'd have to accommodate those types of things. But from a design standpoint, we would really, I think, focus on trying to still build a compelling and interesting test, because I think people like, I mean, it's not a class thing. Like, good design doesn't belong in a certain class. It's not only for wealthy private clubs, it's for everybody. And you can see, you know, Goat Hill in California, you know, Winter Park in Orlando. I mean, these are fun and interesting courses that are very playable, yet they're sound architecturally. They're not just sort of, you know, okay, just beat it around and don't pay attention. So I think we would always still try to focus on building interesting golf courses, no matter what the setting.
Yeah, I think there's a huge market there in the future of doing stuff that's good, instead of just having like the monotonous muni that I grew up playing. So as far as golf courses around the country, you know, say you get 10 rounds, you can take multiple at different courses. You could use all 10 at one if you wanted. How would you split them?
Boy, oh boy, that's a good one.
It's a hard one.
It really is. I mean, you'd have to say, or if I was going to play multiple rounds, it would probably be at National Golflings. I mean, that's like my, aside from the old course. So you did ask me in the United States.
We'll keep it to the U.S.
Yeah, National would probably be 3 rounds, I'd have to say, because it's just all about fun. I mean, I'm an average golfer at best, so I don't need to get beat up. And you can get beat up at National if you're not paying attention, but you can also have the most fun golf experience you've ever had in your life. So I think that would be, we'll say 3 there. You've got a Fisher's Island shirt on, so that would at least be 1 or 2 there, again, just for the beauty. And the thing about Fisher's is that, you know, everybody talks about the views, but there's such great architecture there. I mean, Rainer, the angles and the things, the landforms he used and the setup. I mean, it is.
The spines and the greens.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the stuff that, like, he had those bold external contours. But then when you look at the interiors of the greens, I think that's where he's unbelievable. I mean, like, the greens are just unbelievable at every Rainer you go to. You look at, like, what's inside. And then the unpinnable surfaces, like, I think that's something that people just don't understand. It's unpinnable surface.
Yeah, I mean, Fishers is a special place, and we've had the great fortune of being their consulting architects for 20 plus years. So it's been just this sort of uncovering, peeling back the layers of, it's a wonderful, wonderful spot. So that would get me another one. Cypress Point, you'd have to put in there. So that gets me to 5. LA North would be another. Just again, I think, you know, our experiences there, how much we've learned and just how enjoyable, how playable it is. Pine Valley, again, just for the sheer perfection of 18 holes routed through an amazing landscape and having the variety and the drama. I mean, talk about 18 unforgettable holes on a golf course. So that would be another one. You know, fun golf would be like Myopia Hunt Club. I mean, that's just a blast to be out in that setting. And now I'm like totally on the snob appeal here, right? Because I've got like all these top private clubs. and you know, the one golf course that we've built, I think that's 9, so hopefully 10, that every time I play it, I go, man, I wish I played here more. And it's Boston Golf Club. There's just something about it. It's you know, I think it was early on in our career. We had the luxury of a lot of time. You know, the owners were sort of, hey, let's take 2 years to build this. This is Boston. You know, the weather's not going to cooperate. Gave us a great piece of ground. And there's just, again, I think an emphasis on what we believe in architecture. A lot of fun. There's a lot of width. There's trouble. I mean, you can get yourself in places that you don't want to be. So there's a little bit of Pine Valley in it in that regard. But I think, yeah, if we had to pick, and this, I'm going to piss off all the other clubs we've ever built or designed, but, you know, I think probably one round of Boston Golf Club would be fun.
It's funny, though, because, like, that answer could change, like, 3 months later. You could play somewhere. That's, like, the beauty of golf course. You play somewhere. The more you play somewhere, the more you appreciate it. You might learn something about some place, like, your 150th time around, that you're like, the light goes on, you know, and you're like, whoa.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sitting here now, and I'm just in the back of my head, I'm going, well, you know, Sandhills, duh. Yeah. I mean, that was just, you know, there's so many great golf courses that are out there that, you know, obviously we're all fortunate to, anybody who's listening to this is interested in what we do and in this topic in particular. There's just, yeah, that 10, that's a tough one. May have to peel one of Nationals back and put Sandhills in there.
Say you get one hole in your backyard. It could be someone else's hole. It could be one of your holes. What would it be?
Yeah, the one of my favorite holes to play in the world is number 4 at Fisher's Island. So, you know, the nice thing about that is the Atlantic Ocean would be in my backyard. So that would be a really cool, you know,
bump obviously up your property value.
Yeah, exactly. That would be a pretty exciting place to sit. But yeah, 4 at Fisher's is so cool. I mean, it's just, you know, the combination of the Alps and the Punch Bowl is really special and unique and different. And just the tee shot, you know, with the ocean lurking down the right-hand side, but the further, you know, it's one of those things you talk about, everybody's overwhelmed by the beauty of that golf hole, but it really is a strategic hole. You play close to that edge and you actually get a look around the corner into the bowl. Now, granted, with the way people hit it now, it might be a little bit short for better players, but it's...
you could just put a hickory driver out there.
Exactly, yeah, and just knock it around with that. But every time I walk over that hill and look down into that bowl, the anticipation of where is my shot, where did it find? I love that. I never ever get tired of that type of shot. I know some people really dislike blind shots, but in my mind, that that's one of the greatest walks. We talk about walking golf courses. I feel like people get robbed when they play that golf hole in a cart because they drive around the side and they never get that experience of coming up and over and walking down into that bowl, because that, in my mind, is just, it's a glorious setting. But there's the combination of the beauty of the setting and with that anticipation of the result. And I just think that that's fun.
The stretch of 3 through, like, I think 12 is like the most underrated hole out there, but like 3 through 12, I mean, 13, they're all good, but 3 through 12 is like one of the most exhilarating stretches of golf in the world.
I agree. Yeah, it really is. It's a special, special place.
Have you ever walked around on that? You know, most people don't know that there's originally 36 holes routed there.
Yes. Yeah, I've never tried to walk the other golf course. I know where it was intended to be, but did you try and walk all 18? Did you get kicked off of somebody's property? No.
I got the book and I was reading about it, and Rainer said it was maybe more dramatic than the other one. You always wonder what would have happened had the Great Depression not happened.
Sure.
That kills golf in America. Yeah. We do a overrated, underrated segment. So,
okay.
You have to either pick overrated or underrated on what, you know, these different topics. You can add explanation or you can just say one or the other.
Okay.
Centerline bunkers.
Underrated. I think that they're interesting. We had recently put them in on a hole on the PGA Tour at TPC Boston, and it was met with a vitriol of which we have not been familiar on a lot of our work. So unfortunately, they've been removed from that golf hole. But I think they ask a question that most golfers are not comfortable answering, because it's been so ingrained in us that the technically perfect golf shot is down the middle of a hole. And when all of a sudden the architecture requires the technically perfect golf shot not to be struck, or not, you know, that it's going to get into trouble, people lose their minds on that. And I just think that from an architect's perspective is a very interesting thing to try and insert. Now, you don't want 18 holes of it, but you definitely want to put it in once or twice in a round and make people decide left or right. And, you know, it's interesting. I've talked to some professional golfers and I hate that bunker in the middle of the fairway. And it's like, well, why? Well, that's right where I want to hit it. Well, like on this hole, you don't. You either want to hit it short or left or go right of it or over it. Isn't that more interesting? No, because that's right where I want to hit it. And they just can't get it out of their head that that's not where you want to be on a hole. And so I guess from that standpoint, I really like them, actually.
It's funny. There's a guy I had on the podcast, Scott Fawcett. He does course management for like pros and high level players and college teams. And he talked about the formulaic nature of most golf course architecture and how he could do his job without it even really like studying the course. And then I saw a comment he made about Trinity Forest where he thought it was silly and he was having trouble. And it's so funny because it's like, well, it's not formulaic. It forces you to make decisions. Decisions change on a daily basis. It's like, now, like, how can you not say, like, who cares about score when something requires decision and execution versus just execution?
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm excited to watch Trinity Forest and see what the players, the expectation is that a lot of them won't like it or get it. And, you know, that's unfortunate, because anytime somebody tries to do something interesting and ask these questions of players and have them make decisions and have the proper way to play a golf course when it requires thoughtful consideration and study and care and approach, that's the highest point of golf course architecture. And when that happens a lot of times in professional events, it's poo-pooed or said, well, that's not right, because it's like you said, it's not formulaic. It doesn't fit the mold. And so I think that it's going to require I would almost guarantee that the champion there is going to be a thoughtful player. It's going to be a player, obviously, who can control their ball in the wind, but is somebody who can actually think their way around a golf course. And that, in my mind, should be applauded at a higher level than the players who are just going to say, I don't get this. You know, that unfortunately, the way the media is, not just golf media, all media, they want the negative. They want that big impact splash instead of a guy who says, hey, this is great, it's really thoughtful, et cetera. They want the guy who says, well, this sucks. Mm-hmm. And so that's unfortunately probably what we're going to hear more of. But I'll be excited to watch that tournament, more excited than probably almost any tournament this year.
I'm calling it the fourth major.
Love it.
I hope it doesn't rain. That's like my, if it's firm, I think it'll be just fascinating to watch.
I agree.
So, scale.
Underrated. I think that scale is an important component of everything we do as golf course architects. I think that the appropriate scale, whether the human eye, you know, sort of actively appreciates it, I think it's just the human eye and brain intuitively understands when something's in proper scale as opposed to out of scale. And I think golf courses that are out of scale or features that are out of scale just don't feel right. And I think that that's easy, you know. So I think that an understanding of scale is probably the most important thing I learned in landscape architecture. You know, a lot of what we studied there really had no relevancy to golf course design, but scale was one of the most important elements of sort of the arrangement of a landscape in scale and harmony with nature. I think every golf course, if you can accomplish those goals and make it feel like it's in harmony with its site and its setting, and the scale of it is appropriate from a presentation standpoint, those are the best golf courses.
Philly cheesesteaks.
Real Philly cheesesteaks are underrated outside of Philadelphia. It's over. I would never buy a cheesesteak outside of Philadelphia. They're just horrible. There's just something, I don't know what it is. It's probably all the bad chemicals in the cheese whiz, et cetera, that we put into them in Philadelphia. But they're in Philly, they're awesome.
What's your spot in Philly?
We just have a local place, you know. It's so I don't go to Pat's or Gino's, and you know, we rarely are in the city, you know. My days of drinking in excess until 2 a.m. are over. So it's one of those things where I'm not going to show up at Pat's or Gino's after being on South Street for, you know, hours drinking beers. So it's just, it's a local spot for us that we go to. It's Anthony's in Malvern.
Mm-hmm. Italian beefs are better than Philly cheesesteaks. Just, you know. The Chicagoan.
Absolutely. Oh, I like the Chicago hot dogs. Those Vienna beef hot dogs, those are awesome. And yeah. The rolls with the little poppy seeds on. Fantastic. A little sauerkraut and brown mustard. Perfect.
Ah, you're not even having a real Chicago.
I know. I don't like all that fruity, relishy stuff and onions.
I don't either. I don't eat Chicago dogs. So I'll probably get a lot of hate mail from that. But what about desert golf?
I don't really even think about desert golf all that much. I think there was a time where it was overrated because it was a novelty. It was sort of okay. You know, there was a time in the 80s and 90s where the dramatic sort of difference between green grass and desert landscape was to be promoted and sort of highly thought of as a new, hey, look at this, is the new frontier. You know, obviously people are moving to this area and now we can irrigate and build golf courses in it. I think if good architects build golf courses in those settings, like, you know, Bill and Ben have done a few golf courses down there. I think Tom Weisskopf and the TPC Scottsdale is really thoughtful architecture and well laid out. So, I mean, those I think are great golf, are fantastic golf courses in a desert setting. But as the whole setting of what I've seen of desert golf is probably overrated.
What's the last one? Who's the most underrated band and who's the most overrated band?
Wow. Overrated. I've never been a fan of The Who. I just you know, I like Led Zeppelin. I mean, of that sort of genre, I enjoy Led Zeppelin and the Stones, and but the Who is kind of I can give her, you know, one of the guys I play golf with, he would play the Who live at Leeds over and over again on when we were playing it. I think maybe that just totally put me off of them. So I'd say they're probably probably be my overrated band. Underrated. So I guess the answer to that question would come if I could see any band sort of back together and play, and, you know,
in their prime.
Yeah. Or even now to go back and just get back together. I loved the Talking Heads growing up. And I still love the Talking Heads. I mean, anytime Burning Down the House comes on, the speaker's just going up. It's just one of those things. And to see them again would be really cool. And they're actually, I think all four of them still alive. So it would be a possibility. So yeah, I think from a sort of that genre, you know, that new wave time frame where things were sort of changing and going over, they did a really cool job of straddling that punk, new wave, rock line. And David Byrne, I think, is really an amazing performer. So yeah, I probably would go Talking Heads.
They have some songs that there are a few songs where you can listen to it in any setting.
Yeah, that's true.
And like, you could be just chilling like on your couch night in, you could be at a rager.
Yeah.
You could put it on and everybody be like,
yeah. You know, another band that I really like that I think they do, they're very artisty is Counting Crows. I listen to Counting Crows all the time, just sort of, you know, as a more mellow alternative, but, you know, you don't hear a ton about them. And obviously, we've already had the huge Deadhead and Dave Matthews are my favorites, but I don't want to get them into the conversation of overrated, underrated.
I got one last question. It's a theory that I've thought of a lot. I asked Jeff Ogilvy about this, and he actually was like, I actually think about that too. Do you ever think about like the trends in architecture as music genres? Like where Pete Dye was like this kind of music with his style of architecture, and the Golden Age was this, and like...
Yeah, I do. I actually do. I think there's something to that. And I also think about architects and obviously and the personalities of sort of, okay, you know, Bill Coore would be like James Taylor. He would just be the most mellow, relaxed, but so good. I mean, so yeah, we definitely, I give that some thought. And, you know, when you're in the bulldozer and you're pushing dirt for a long period of time, there's all kinds of things that cross your mind. And that might be one of them that, you know, and as we talked about, my appreciation for music and the involvement it has actually in our working, my working environment is pretty, pretty cool.
All right, Gil, thanks so much for the time. We look forward to seeing your new designs and all that's not just going on now, but what's going on in the future. And thanks for coming on.
I appreciate it. Thanks. I've really enjoyed it. Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.